Their faith is not dead, of course, but their sultans are gone forever, and I have outlived them."
I thought for a moment that he might laugh, but his next words were grave.
"Here are great books made for the sultan about his many lands. Here is the history of Mehmed, may he rot in hell, by a Christian historian turned flatterer. May he rot in hell also. I tried to find him myself, that historian, but he died before I could reach him. Here are the accounts of Mehmed's campaigns by his own flatterers and the fall of the great city. You do not read Arabic?"
"Very little."
"Ah, I had the opportunity to learn their language and their writing while I was their prisoner. You know that I was in bondage to them."
I nodded, trying not to look at him.
"Yes. My own father left me to the father of Mehmed as a pledge that we would not wage war against the Empire. Imagine, Dracula a pawn in the hands of the infidel. I wasted no time there. I learned everything I could about them, so that I might surpass them all. That was when I vowed to make history, not to be its victim."
His voice was so fierce that I glanced at him in spite of myself and saw the terrible blaze in his face, the hatred, the sharp upward curl of the mouth under its long moustache. Then he did laugh, and the sound was equally horrifying.
"I have triumphed, and they are gone!"
He put his hand on a finely tooled leather binding and straightened his powerful body.
"Come, I will show you my other treasures, and you must tell me how you propose to catalogue them all."
After I ate, he led me from one section of the room to another, pointing out particular rarities. Here was a large cabinet full of manuals of torture, some of them dating to the ancient world. They ranged through the prisons of medieval England, the torture chambers of the Inquisition, the experiments of the Third Reich. Another section of the room chronicled the church heresies, for which many of those manuals of torture had been employed. Another corner was dedicated to alchemy, another to witchcraft, another to philosophy of the most disturbing sort. Dracula paused in front of a great bookshelf and laid his hand on it affectionately.
"This is of special interest to me, and will be to you as well, I think. These works are my biographies."
Each volume there was connected in some way to his life. There were works by Byzantine and Ottoman historians, some of them very rare originals, and their many reprints through the ages. There were pamphlets from medieval Germany, Russia, Hungary, Constantinople, all documenting his crimes. Many of them I'd neither seen nor heard of in my research, and I felt an unreasonable flare of curiosity before I remembered that I had no reason now to complete that research. There were also numerous volumes of folklore from the 17th century on, ranging over the legend of the vampire. It struck me as strange and terrible that he included these so frankly among his own biographies. He brought his great hand to rest on an early edition of Bram Stoker's novel, and smiled, but said nothing. Then he moved quietly away into another section.
"And these are works of history about your century, the 20th. A fine century. I look forward to the rest of it. In my day, a prince was able to eliminate troublesome elements only one person at a time. You do this with an infinitely greater sweep. Think, for example, of the improvement from the accursed cannon that broke the walls of Constantinople to the divine fire your adoptive country dropped onto the Japanese cities some years ago."
He gave me the trace of a bow, courtly, congratulatory.
"You will have read many of these works already, Professor, but perhaps you will glance through them with a new perspective."
At last he bade me settle by the fire again, and I found more of the steaming tea waiting at my elbow. When we were both resting in our chairs, he turned to me.
Soon I must take my own refreshment. But first, I will ask you a question.
My hands began to tremble in spite of myself. I had tried until now to speak to him as little as possible without incurring his rage.
You have enjoyed my hospitality, such as I can offer here, and my boundless faith in your gifts. You shall enjoy the eternal life that only a few beings can claim. You have the free run of what is certainly the finest archive of its kind on the face of the earth. Rare works are open to you that, indeed, cannot now be seen anywhere else. All this is yours. I ask you, my friend, to join me of your own accord in my research. If you do so, you will save yourself great anguish, and you will save me considerable trouble. Together we will advance the historian's work beyond anything the world has ever seen. There is no purity like the purity of the sufferings of history. You will have what every historian wants. History will be reality to you. We will wash our minds clean with blood.
He turned the full flood of his gaze on me then. The eyes with their ancient knowledge blazing up and the red lips parted. It would have been a face of the most exquisite intelligence, I suddenly thought, if it had not been shaped by so much hatred. I summoned my love of all I had had in my life, and I formed the word as firmly as I could. Never. His face kindled pale, the nostrils and lips twitching.
You will certainly die here, Professor Rossi. You will never leave these chambers alive, although you will go out from them in a new life. Why not have some choice in the matter?
No. He stood menacingly and smiled.
Then, you shall work for me against your will.
A darkness began to pool before my eyes, and I held internally to my small reserve of... what? My skin began to tingle, and stars came out in front of me against the dim walls of the chamber. When he stepped closer, I saw his face unmasked, a sight so terrible that I cannot remember it now. I have tried. Then I did not know anything else. For a long time. I woke in my sarcophagus, in the dark again, and I thought it was once again the first day, my first awakening there, until I realized that I'd known immediately where I was. I was very weak, much weaker this time, and the wound in my neck oozed and throbbed. I had lost blood, but not so much as to incapacitate me completely. After some time, I managed to move around, to climb, trembling, out of my imprisonment. I remembered the moment I had lost consciousness. I saw, by the glow of the remaining candles, that Dracula slept again in his great tomb. His eyes were open, glassy, his lips red. I turned away in the deepest horror of body and soul, and went to crouch by the fire, and to try to eat the meal I found there. Apparently he means to destroy me gradually, perhaps to leave open to me until the last minute the choice he presented last night, so that I might still bring him all the power of a willing mind. I have only one purpose now, no, two, to die with as much of myself intact as I can, in the hope that it may later be some small restraint on the terrible deeds I will do, once I am undead, and to stay alive long enough to write all I can in this record, although it will probably crumble to dust, unread. These ambitions are my only sustenance now. It is a fate beyond anything I could weep for. Third day. I am no longer completely certain of the day. I begin to feel that some other days may have passed, or that I have dreamed several weeks, or that my abduction occurred a month ago. In any case, this is my third writing. I spent the night examining the library, not in order to fulfill Dracula's wishes that I catalogue it for him, but to learn whatever I could from it that might be of benefit to anyone. But it is hopeless. I must sleep again a little while Dracula does, so that I can face my next ordeal somewhat rested. Whatever happens. Fourth day? My mind itself begins to crumble. I do not simply feel weak, but ill. And today I had a sensation that sent fresh misery through what remains of my heart. I was looking at a work in Dracula's unparalleled archive on torture, and I saw, in a fine French quarto there, the design for a new machine that would cleave heads instantaneously from their bodies. There was an engraving to illustrate this, the parts of the machine, the man in elegant dress, whose theoretical head had just been separated from its theoretical body. As I looked at this design, I felt not only disgust at its purpose, not only wonder at the wonderful condition of the book, but also a sudden longing to see the real scene, to hear the shouts of the crowd, and see the spurt of blood over that lace jabot and velvet jacket. Every historian knows the thirst to see the reality of the past, but this was something new, a different sort of hunger. I flung the book aside, put my throbbing head down on the table, and wept for the first time since my imprisonment began. I had not wept in years, since my mother's funeral. The salt of my own tears comforted me a little. It was so ordinary. Day. The monster sleeps. But he did not speak to me all of yesterday, except to ask me how the catalogue is coming along, and to examine my work on it for a few minutes. I am too tired to continue the task just now, or even to type much. I will sit in front of the fire, and try to collect a little of my old self there. Day. Last night, he sat me before the fire again, as if we were still holding civilized discourse, and told me that he will move the library soon, sooner than he had originally intended, because some threat to it is drawing closer.
This will be your last night, and then I will leave you here. But you will come to me when I call for you. Then you may resume your work in a new and safer place.
So, it is only a matter of a short time before he finishes my mortal life. Now, all my energy goes to strengthening myself for the last moments. I am careful not to think of the people I have loved, in the hope that I will be less likely to think of them in my next damned state. I will hide this record in the most beautiful book I have found here, one of the few works in the library that does not now give me a horrified pleasure. And then I will hide that book as well, so that it will cease to belong to this archive. If only I could consign myself to dust with it. I feel sunset approaching, somewhere out in the world where light and dark still exist. And I will use all my waning energy to remain myself to the last moment. If there is any good in life, in history, in my own past, I invoke it now. I invoke it with all the passion with which I have lived.
Helen touched her father's forehead with two fingers, as if conferring a blessing. She was fighting sobs now.
How can we move him out of here? I want to bury him.
There's no time. He'd rather we got out alive, I'm sure. I took my jacket off and spread it gently over him, covering his face. The stone lid was too heavy to put back on. Helen picked up her little pistol, carefully checking it even in the midst of her emotion.
The library. We must find it immediately. And did you hear something a moment ago?
I nodded. I think I did, but I couldn't tell where it was coming from. We stood listening hard. The silence hung unbroken above us. Helen was trying the walls now, feeling along them with her pistol in one hand. Then a sudden thought made me snatch a candle from the stand and crouch down. Helen followed me swiftly.
Yes.
I was touching the carved dragon on the vertical of the lowest step. I had stroked it with my finger during our first visit to the crypt. Now I pushed it hard, put my weight into it. It was firm in the wall, but Helen's sensitive hands were already feeling the stones around it, and she suddenly found a loose one. It simply came out in her hand like a tooth, from where it was embedded next to the dragon carving. A small dark hole gaped where it had been. I put my hand in and waved it around, but encountered only space. Helen slipped hers in, however, and brought it back toward the dragon, behind the carving.
Paul!
I followed her grasp into the dark. There was certainly a handle there, a large handle of cold iron, and when I pushed on it, the dragon lifted easily out of its space under the step without disturbing any of the other stones around it, or the step above it. It was a finely chiseled piece of work we saw now, with an iron handle in the shape of a horned beast drilled into it, presumably so you could pull it shut behind you when you went down the narrow stone steps opening before us. Helen took a second candle and I grabbed the matches. We entered on hands and knees. I remembered suddenly Rossi's bruised and scraped appearance, his torn clothes, and wondered if he'd been dragged more than once through this opening. But we were soon able to stand upright on the steps. The air that came up to meet us was cold and dank in the extreme, and I fought to control a trembling deep inside and to keep a firm hold on Helen, who was also trembling during the steep descent. At the bottom of 15 steps was a passage, infernally dark, although our candlelight showed iron sconces pinned high on the walls, as if it had once sometimes been illuminated. At the end of the passageway, again, it seemed to me about 15 steps forward, and I was careful to count them, was a door of heavy and clearly very old wood, wearing into splinters near the bottom, and again that eerie door handle, a long-horned creature wrought in iron. I felt, more than saw, Helen raise her pistol. The door was wedged firm, but on examining it closely, I found it bolted from the side we were on. I put all my weight under the heavy latch, and then I pulled the door open with a slow fear that nearly melted my bones. Inside, the light of our candles, feeble as it was, fell on a great chamber. There were tables near the door, long tables of an ancient solidity, and empty bookshelves. The air of the room was surprisingly dry after the chill of the passage, as if it had some secret ventilation or was dug into a protected depth of earth. We stood clinging to each other and listened hard, but there was no sound in the room. I wished devoutly that we could see the edges of the room. The next thing our light picked up was a branching candelabrum filled with half-burned candles, and this I lit all over. It illuminated high cabinets now, and I looked cautiously inside one of them. It was empty. Is this the library? There's nothing here. We stood still again, listening, and Helen's pistol glinted in the increased light. I thought that I should have offered to carry it, to use it if necessary, but I had never handled a gun, and she, I knew very well, was a crack shot.
Look, Paul.
She pointed with her free hand, and I saw what had caught her gaze. Helen! But she was moving forward. After a second, my light reached a table that had not been illuminated before, a great stone table. It was not a table I saw an instant later, but a sarcophagus. There was another nearby. Had this been a continuation of the monastery's crypt? A place where its abbots could rest in peace, away from Byzantine torches and Ottoman catapults? Then we saw beyond them the largest sarcophagus of all. Along the side ran one word, cut into the stone. Dracula. Helen raised her gun and I gripped my stake. She took a step forward, and I kept close to her. At that moment we heard a commotion behind us, at a distance, and the crash of footsteps and scrambling bodies, which almost obscured the faint sound in the darkness beyond the tomb, a trickling of dry earth. We leaped forward like one being and looked in. The sarcophagus had no covering slab, and it was empty. All three were empty, and that sound. Somewhere in the darkness, some small creature was making its way up through the tree roots. Helen fired into the dark, and there was a crashing of earth and pebbles. I ran forward with my light. The end of the library was a dead end, with a few roots hanging down from the vaulted ceiling. In the niche on the back wall, where an icon might once have stood, I saw a trickle of black slime on the bare stones. Blood? An infiltration of moisture from the earth? The door behind us burst open, and we swung around, my hand on Helen's free arm. Into our candlelight came a strong lantern, flashlights, hurrying forms, a shout. It was Ranulf, and with him, a tall figure whose shadow leapt forward to engulf us. Geza Yosef, and at his heels, a terrified Brother Ivan. He was followed by a wiry little bureaucrat in dark suit and hat, with a heavy dark mustache. There was another figure, too, one who moved haltingly and whose slow progress I realize now must have hampered them at every step. Stoichev. His face was a strange mixture of fear, regret, and curiosity, and there was a bruise on his cheek. His old eyes met ours for a long, sorrowful moment, and then he moved his lips, as if thanking his god to find us alive. Geza and Ranulf were on us in a fraction of a second. Ranulf had a gun trained on me and Geza on Helen, while the monk stood open-mouthed and Stoichev waited, quiet and wary, behind them. The dark-suited bureaucrat stood just out of the light.
Drop your gun!
Helen let it fall obediently to the floor. I put my arm around her, but slowly. In the gloomy candlelight, their faces looked more than sinister, except for Stoichev's. I saw that he would have hazarded a smile at us if he had dared.
Geza! What the hell are you doing here?
What the hell are you doing here, my dear?
Geza looked taller than ever, dressed in a pale shirt and pants and heavy walking boots. I hadn't realized at the conference that I actually hated his guts.
Where is he?
He looked from me to Helen. He's dead. You came through the crypt, you must have seen him. Ranulf frowned.
What are you talking about?
Something, some instinct I owed to Helen, perhaps, stopped me from saying more.
Whom do you mean?
Geza trained his gun a little more exactly on her.
You know what I mean, Elena Rossi. Where is Dracula?
This was easier to answer, and I let Helen go first.
He is not here, evidently.
Ranulf was already peering into the sarcophagi.
Empty. Search the room.
Geza was striding among the tables, holding his light up to every wall, opening cabinets.
Did you see him or hear him?
No. I was speaking more or less truthfully. Geza said something that must have been a curse in Hungarian, because Helen nearly smiled, despite the gun aimed at her heart.
It is useless. The tomb in the crypt is empty, and this one is also. And he will never return to this place since we have found it.
It took me a moment to digest this. The tomb in the crypt was empty? Then where was Rossi's body, which we just left there? Geza kicked the leg of one of the ancient tables.
What am I going to say to the Minister of Culture? That Wallachian belonged to us. He was a Hungarian prisoner, and his country was our territory.
Why don't we quarrel about that when we find him?
I realized suddenly that their only common language was English, and that they loathed each other. At that moment, the light from Ranulf's lantern suddenly fell in a new direction. It slanted across the face of the dark-suited, severely hatted little bureaucrat, who was standing silently by Dracula's empty sarcophagus. Perhaps I wouldn't have noticed his face at all if it hadn't been for the strange expression it wore. A look of private grief. I could see plainly the bone-thin face under the awkward mustache and the familiar glitter of the eyes. Helen, look! She stared too.
What?
Helen was aghast. Geza turned on her in an instant. This man, that man there, he's a vampire. He followed us from our university in the United States. I had barely begun to speak before the creature was in flight. He had to come straight toward us to get out, barreling into Geza, who tried to seize him and pushing past Ranulf. Ranulf was quicker on his feet. He grabbed the librarian, they collided hard, and then Ranulf leapt back from him with a cry, and the librarian was in flight again. Ranulf turned and shot the hurtling figure before it was many feet away. It didn't falter for a second. Ranulf might have been shooting into air. Then, the evil librarian was gone. Geza took a step back from Ranulf.
My God! He bit you! And I was alone with the man several times. He said he could tell me where we could find these Americans. But he never told me he was...
gone.
Ranulf was hurting us with his gun again, one hand on his wounded shoulder.
You have been a very little assistance. I want you back in Sofia and on the plane as soon as possible. You are lucky we don't have permission to make you disappear. It would be too inconvenient.
I thought he was going to kick us, but he turned instead and ushered us brusquely out of the library. I looked back once from the doorway at the princely sarcophagus that had lain here for nearly 500 years. Its occupant might be anywhere now, or on his way to anywhere. At the top of the steps we crawled one by one through the opening. I prayed none of those guns would go off. And there I saw something very strange. The reliquary of St. Petko sat open on its pedestal. They must have had some tools to open it where we had failed. The marble slab underneath was back in place and covered with its embroidered cloth, undisturbed. Helen shot me a blank look. Glancing into the reliquary as we passed it, I saw a few pieces of bone, a polished skull, all that remained of the local martyr. Outside the church, in the heavy night, there was a confusion of cars and people. Geza had apparently arrived with an entourage, two of whom were guarding the church doors. Dracula certainly hadn't escaped that way, I thought. Stoichev caught my arm, his face bobbed near my ear. I bent to listen to him.
We closed it.
What?
The monk and I went down first into the crypt, while those thugs searched the church and the woods for you. We saw the man in the grave, not Dracula. And I knew you had been there. So we closed it up, and when they came down, they opened the reliquary only. They were so angry then that I thought they would throw out the poor saint's bones. But who was that in the grave underneath, if it was not?
It was Professor Rossi.
Ranulf was opening car doors, ordering us in. Stoichev gave me a quick, eloquent look.
I am so sorry.
That is how we left my dearest friend resting in Bulgaria. May he sleep there in peace until the end of the world. After our adventure in the crypt, the Bora's front parlor looked like heaven on earth.
Are you certain that the tomb was empty?
Tergut had asked it once already, but seemed unable to refrain from asking again. I glanced at Helen. Quite sure. What we don't know is whether the noise we heard was the sound of Dracula escaping somehow as we came in. It was probably dark outside by then, and easy for him to move around.
Where do you think he went?
Helen leaned forward, her eyes intensely dark. Tergut stroked his big chin.
Well, my dear, I cannot guess. He can travel far and fast, but I do not know how far he would go. To another ancient site, I am sure, some hiding place that has been undisturbed for centuries. It must have been a blow for him to leave Sveti Georgi, but he would understand that this site will be guarded now for a long time to come.
You do not think he would follow us?
Something in the angle of Helen's shoulders made me think that the very simplicity with which she asked this question cost her an effort. Tergut shook his head.
I hope not, Madam Professor. I should think he would be a little afraid of you two by now, since you found him when no one else could. And I am deeply sorry about your friend Rossi. I would have liked to meet him.
And I know you would have enjoyed each other's company. I took Helen's hand. Her eyes filled whenever Rossi's name came up, and now she looked away as if for privacy.
I was wondering if in the midst of all that danger and chaos you saw the book that Professor Rossi described, A Life of St. George, was it not? Did the Bulgarians take it to the university in Sofia?
Helen's laugh could be surprisingly girlish when she was really delighted, and I refrained from kissing her soundly in front of all of them. She had barely smiled since we'd left Rossi's grave. It is in my briefcase, for the moment. Tergut stared, astounded.
And how did it find a home there?
Helen was mute, smiling, so I explained. I didn't think of it again myself until we were back in Sofia at the hotel. No, I couldn't tell them the whole truth, so I gave them a polite version. The whole truth was that when we had finally been alone together for 10 minutes in Helen's hotel room, I took her into my arms and kissed her smoky dark hair, pulled her against my shoulder, fitting her to me through our soiled travel clothes like the other part of myself. But I felt something inexplicably wrong about her body, something lumpy and hard. I drew back and saw her wry smile. After a second, she put my hands on the buttons of her blouse, which was now shabby and dirty from our adventures. I unbuttoned it without letting myself dare to think and drew it off. Wrapped in a handkerchief and warmed against Helen's skin was a book. Not the great folio I'd imagined when Rossi had told us about its existence, but a volume small enough to fit in my hand. Its casing was elaborately patterned gold over painted wooden leather. The gold was set with emeralds, rubies, sapphires, lapis, fine pearls, a little firmament of jewels, all to honor the face of the saint at the center. His delicate Byzantine features looked as if they'd been painted a few days earlier, rather than centuries. Inside were small sheets of parchment in breathtakingly good condition, each covered in a fine medieval hand, also Greek. Here and there I saw exquisite pages of illustration. St. George driving his spear into the maw of a writhing dragon while a crowd of nobles looked on. St. George receiving a tiny gilded crown from Christ, who reached down with it from his heavenly throne. St. George on his deathbed, mourned by red-winged angels. Each was filled with astounding miniature detail. Holding the book carefully in both hands, I sat down on the edge of the bed next to Helen. The inside front cover had a deep flap of leather over it, and she reached carefully inside this. She drew out a fold of thin paper covered with dense typing. Then we read together, in silence, Rossi's agonized journal. When we were done, neither of us spoke, although we were both weeping. Finally, Helen wrapped the book in the handkerchief again and put it carefully back in its hiding place against her skin. Tergut smiled as I finished a diluted version of this story.
What will you do with this book when you go home?
I know someone who has a connection with an auction house. We will be very careful, of course, and we'll wait a while before we do anything. I expect some museum will get it sooner or later.
And the money, what will you do with so much?
We're thinking it over. Something in the service of good. We don't yet know what. The last part of my story is perhaps the hardest for me to tell, since it begins with so much happiness in spite of everything. We returned quietly to the university and took up our work again. Helen and I were married in my parents' church in Boston that autumn. Even in the midst of the ceremony, I couldn't help noticing how bare and plain it was, how devoid of incense. Although I often felt the pain of Rossi's death and the frequent melancholy it seemed to cause in Helen, I found that first year full of a brimming joy. I finished my dissertation under a second advisor, whose face remained a blur to me throughout the process. It was not that I cared about Dutch merchants anymore. I only wanted to complete my education so that I could settle us comfortably somewhere. Helen published a long article on Wallachian village superstitions, which was well received, and began a dissertation on the remnants of Transylvanian customs in Hungary. We wrote something else, too, as soon as we returned to the States. A note to Helen's mother, care of Aunt Eva. Helen didn't dare to put much information into it, but she told her mother in a few brief lines that Rossi had died remembering and loving her. Helen sealed the letter with a look of despair on her face.
I will tell her everything someday, when I can whisper it into her ear.
We never knew for certain whether this letter reached its destination, because neither Aunt Eva nor Helen's mother wrote back, and within a year Soviet troops had invaded Hungary. I fully intended to live happily ever after, and I mentioned to Helen soon after we married that I hoped we would have children. At first she shook her head, touching the scar on her neck with gentle fingers. I knew what she meant, but her exposure had been minimal, I pointed out. She was well and strong and healthy. As time went by, she seemed lulled by her own complete recovery, and I saw her looking with wistful eyes into the baby carriages we passed on the street. When I got my first teaching job in New York City, she urged me to take it, and we moved. We settled in Brooklyn Heights in a pleasantly run-down brownstone. Helen was teaching, too. There was a magnificent balance to our lives, and we were making a living doing what we liked best. Now and then we took out the life of St. George and looked slowly through it. And the day came when we went to a discreet auction house with it, and the Englishman who opened it nearly fainted. It was sold privately, and eventually made its way to the cloisters in Upper Manhattan, and a great deal of money made its way into a bank account we had set up for the purpose. Helen disliked elaborate living as much as I did, and apart from the attempt to send small amounts to her relatives in Hungary, we left the money alone, for the time being. Helen became pregnant, and grew as soft-eyed as a Madonna, her form round under her blue wool dress, her walk a little unsteady. She was always smiling. You were born in a hospital overlooking the Hudson. When I saw that you were dark and fine-browed like your mother, and as perfect as a new coin, and that Helen's eyes were overflowing with tears of pleasure and pain, I held you up in your tight cocoon to give you a glimpse of the ships below. That was partly to hide my own tears. We named you for Helen's mother. Helen was enthralled by you. I would like you to know that fact more than almost anything else about our lives. She had left her teaching during the pregnancy and seemed content to spend hours at home playing with your fingers and feet, which she said with a wicked smile were completely Transylvanian, or rocking you in the big chair I bought her. You smiled early, and your eyes followed us everywhere. I left my office on impulse sometimes to come home and make sure the two of you, my dark-haired women, were still lying drowsily on the sofa together. One day I arrived home early at 4, bringing some little boxes of Chinese food and some flowers for you to stare at. No one was in the living room, and I found Helen leaning over your crib while you took a nap. Your face was exquisitely tranquil and asleep, but Helen's was smeared with tears, and for a second she didn't seem to register my presence. I took her into my arms and felt, with a chill, that something in her returned only slowly to my embrace. She wouldn't tell me what had been troubling her, and after a few futile rounds I didn't dare question her further. Soon Helen was silent almost every morning, and cried for no apparent reason every evening. But since she wouldn't talk to me, I insisted she see a doctor, and then a psychoanalyst. The doctor said he could find nothing wrong with her, that women were sometimes blue during the first months of motherhood, that she would be fine once she got used to it. I discovered too late, when a friend of ours ran into Helen at the New York Public Library, that she had not been going to the analyst at all. When I confronted her with this, she said she decided that some research would cheer her up more, and had been using the babysitter's time for that instead. But her mood was so low some evenings that I concluded she desperately needed a change of scene. I took a little money from our hoard and bought airline tickets to France for early spring. Helen had never been to France, although she'd read about it all her life and spoken excellent schoolgirl French. She looked cheerful on Montmartre. She liked pushing your carriage in the flower markets and along the Seine. You were an excellent traveler at 9 months, and Helen told you it was only the beginning. Helen wanted to visit the ancient monastery of Saint-Mathieu des Pyrénées Orientales, and we decided to go there for a day or two before returning for Paris and the flight home. I thought her face had brightened considerably on the trip, and I liked the way she lay sprawled across our hotel bed in Perpignan, flipping through a history of French architecture that I'd bought in Paris. Helen insisted that we approach the monastery on foot, like pilgrims. We climbed the road from Les Bains on a cool spring morning. I noted with anxiety and frustration that Helen's eyes filled with tears from time to time. I knew already that if I asked her what was wrong, she would shake her head, shake me off, so I tried to content myself with holding you tenderly as we climbed, pointing out the views to you when we turned a bend in the road. At the summit of the mountain, the road broke into a wide estuary of dust. The monastery rose above this area, heavy stone walls climbing the very summit, and we went up through the entrance and into the care of the monks. In those days, Saint-Mathieu was much more a working monastery than it is now, and it must have had a community of 12 or 13, leading the lives their predecessors had for 1,000 years, with the exception of the fact that they gave the occasional tour to visitors and kept an automobile parked for their own use outside the gates. 2 monks showed us around the exquisite cloisters. I remember how surprised I was when I went to the open end of the courtyard and saw that sheer drop over outcroppings of rock, the vertical cliff, the plains below. We sat a while on a bench near this precipice, with you balanced between us, looking out at the enormous noon sky and listening to the bubbling water in the monastery cistern at the center, carved of red marble. Heaven only knew how they'd hauled that up here centuries before. Helen seemed more cheerful again, and I noted with pleasure the peace in her face. Even if she was still sad at times, this trip had been well worthwhile. Eventually, Helen said she wanted to see more of the place. We put you back in your sack and went around to the kitchens and the long refectory where the monks still ate, and the hostel where pilgrims could still sleep on cots, and the scriptorium, one of the oldest parts of the complex, where so many great manuscripts had been copied and illuminated. At last the young monk who was our guide said we'd seen everything but the crypt, and we followed him down there. It was a small, dank hole off the cloisters, architecturally interesting for an early Romanesque vault held up by a few squat columns, and for a grimly ornamented stone sarcophagus dating from the earliest century of the monastery's existence, the resting place of their first abbot, said our guide. Next to the sarcophagus sat an elderly monk lost in his meditations. He looked up, kind and confused, when we entered, and bowed to us without rising from his chair.
We have had a tradition here for centuries, that one of us sits with the abbot. Usually it is an older monk who has held his honor for his lifetime.
How unusual! But something about the place, perhaps the chill, made you whimper and struggle on Helen's chest. And seeing that she was tired, I offered to take you up to the fresh air. I stepped out of that dank hole with some relief myself and went to show you the fountain and the cloisters. I expected Helen to follow me at once, but she lingered underground, and when she came up again, her face was so changed that I felt a rush of alarm. She looked animated, yes, more lively than I'd seen her in months, but also pale and wide-eyed, intent on something I couldn't see. I moved toward her as casually as I could. I asked her if there'd been anything else of interest down there.
Maybe.
She spoke, but as if she couldn't quite hear me for the roar of thoughts inside. Then she turned to you suddenly and took you from me, hugging you and kissing your head and cheeks.
Is she all right? Was she frightened?
She's fine. A little hungry, maybe. Helen sat down on a bench, fished out a jar of baby food, and began to feed you, singing you one of those little songs I couldn't understand. Hungarian or Romanian, while you ate.
This is a beautiful place. Let's stay for a couple of days.
We have to get back to Paris by Thursday night.
Well, there is not much difference between staying here for a night and staying in Les Bains. We can walk down tomorrow and catch the bus, if you think we need to go so soon.
I agreed because she seemed so strange, but I felt some reluctance even as I went to discuss this with the tour guide monk. He applied to his superior, who said that the hostel was empty and we were welcome. A monk made up our cots with clean, coarse sheets. After you fell asleep on one of them, with ours pushed up close on either side so that you couldn't roll out, I lay reading and pretending not to watch Helen. She stretched out and covered herself, and appeared to drift off long before I'd finished my chapter and blown out the lantern. I woke at dawn, feeling a sort of breeze go through the room. It was very quiet. You breathed next to me under your wool baby blanket, but Helen's cot was empty. I got up soundlessly and put on my shoes and jacket. The cloisters outside were dim, the courtyard gray, the fountain a shadowy mass. I looked all around for Helen. I began to call her name quietly, and then louder, and then in alarm. After a few minutes, one of the monks came out of the refectory and asked if he could help me. I explained that my wife was missing, and he began to search with me.
Perhaps Madame went for a walk.
But there was no sign of her in the orchard or the parking area or the dark crypt. We looked everywhere as the sun came over the peaks, and then he went for some other monks, and one of them said he would take the car down to Les Bains to make inquiries. I asked him on impulse to bring the police back with him. Then I heard you crying in the hostel. I hurried to you, afraid you'd rolled off the cots, but you were just waking. I fed you quickly and kept you in my arms while we looked in the same places again. Finally, I asked that all the monks be gathered and questioned. The abbot gave his consent readily and brought them into the cloisters. No one had seen Helen after we'd left the kitchens for the hostel the night before. Everyone was worried. La pauvre, said one old monk, which sent a wave of irritation through me. I asked if anyone had spoken with her the day before or noticed anything strange.
We do not speak with women, as a general rule.
But one monk stepped forward, and I recognized at once the old man whose job it was to sit in the crypt. His face was as tranquil and kind as it had been by lantern light in the crypt the day before, with that mild confusion I had noted then.
Madame stopped to speak to me. I did not like to break our rule, but she was such a quiet, polite lady that I answered her questions.
What did she ask you? My heart had already been pounding, but now it began to race painfully.
She asked me who was buried there, and I explained that it was one of our first abbots, and that we revere his memory. Then she asked what great things he had done, and I explained that we have a legend.
Here he glanced at the abbot, who nodded for him to continue.
We have a legend that he had a saintly life, but was the unfortunate recipient of a curse in death, so that he rose from his coffin to do harm to the monks, and his body had to be purified.
When it was purified, a white rose grew out of his heart to signify the Holy Mother's forgiveness.
And this is why someone sits guard on him? The abbot shrugged.
That is simply our tradition, to honor his memory.
I turned to the old monk, stifling a desire to throttle him and see his gentle face turn blue. Is this the story you told my wife?
She asked me about our history, monsieur.
I did not see anything wrong with answering her questions.
And what did she say to you in response? He smiled.
She thanked me in her sweet voice and asked me my name, and I told her, Frère Kirill.
He folded his hands over his waist. It took me a moment to make sense of these sounds, the name made unfamiliar by a francophone stress on the second syllable, by that innocent frère. Then I tightened my arms around you so I wouldn't drop you. Did you say your name is Kirill? Is that what you said? Spell it. The astonished monk obliged. Where did this name come from? I couldn't keep my voice from shaking. Is it your real name? Who are you? The abbot stepped in, perhaps because the old man seemed genuinely perplexed.
It is not his given name. We all take names when we take our vows. There has always been a Kirill. Someone always has this name. And a Frère Michel, this one here.
Do you mean to tell me that there was a brother Kirill before this one and one before him? I held you fast while the abbot was clearly puzzled now by my fierce questioning.
Oh, yes. As long in our history as anyone knows, we are proud of our traditions here. We do not like the new ways.
Where did this tradition come from?
We don't know that, monsieur. It has always been our way here.
I stepped close to him and put my nose almost against his. I want you to open the sarcophagus in the crypt. He stepped back, aghast.
What are you saying? We can't do that.
Come with me. Here. I gave you quickly to the young monk who'd shown us around the day before. Please hold my daughter. He took you, not as awkwardly as one might have expected, and held you in his arms. You began to cry. Come. I drew the abbot toward the crypt, and he gestured for the other monks to stay behind. We went quickly down the steps. In the chill hole where Brother Kirill had left two candles burning, I turned to the abbot. You don't have to tell anyone about this, but I must see inside that sarcophagus. I paused for emphasis. If you don't help me, I will bring the whole weight of the law down on your monastery. He flashed me a look. Fear, resentment, pity, and went without speaking to one end of the sarcophagus. Together, we slid aside the heavy cover, just far enough to see inside. I held up one of the candles. The sarcophagus was empty. The abbot's eyes were huge, and he slid the lid back with a mighty shove. We regarded each other. He had a fine, shrewd face that I might have liked immensely in another situation.
Please do not tell the brothers about this.
He turned and climbed out of the crypt. I followed him, struggling to think what I should do next. I would take you and go back to Les Bains immediately, I decided, and make sure the police had actually been alerted. Maybe Helen had decided to return to Paris ahead of us. Why, I couldn't imagine. Or even to fly home. I could feel a terrible pounding in my ears, my heart, in my throat, blood rising in my mouth. By the time I stepped into the cloisters again, where the sun was now flooding the fountain and the birds were singing and lighting on the ancient paving, I knew what had happened. I had tried hard for an hour not to think it, but now I almost didn't need the news, the sight of two monks running toward the abbot, calling out. I remembered that these two had been dispatched to search outside the monastery walls. They had just come from the steep side. One of them pointed to the edge of the cloister where Helen and I sat with you between us on a bench the day before, looking down into that measureless chasm. One of them cried as if he could not even begin to address me directly.
Lord Abbot! Lord Abbot! There is blood on the rocks down there below!
There are no words for such moments. I ran to the edge of the cloisters, clinging to you, feeling your petal-smooth cheek against my neck. The first of my tears were welling in my eyes, and they were hot and bitter beyond anything I'd ever known. I looked over the low wall. On an outcropping of rock 15 feet below, there was a scarlet splash, not large, but distinct in the morning sun. Below that, the gulf yawned, the mists rose, the eagles hunted, the mountains fell to their very roots. I ran for the main gate. stumbled around the outer walls. The precipice was so steep that even if I hadn't been holding you, I could not have climbed down safely to that first outcropping. I stood watching a wave of loss come through the celestial air toward me, through that beautiful morning. Then my grief reached me, an unspeakable fire. I stayed there 3 weeks at Les Bains and the monastery, searching the cliffs and forests with the local police and with a team called in from Paris. Day after day I scoured the woods at the foot of the cliff, sometimes in the company of a cold-faced detective and his team, sometimes alone with my tears. At first, I wanted only to see Helen alive, walking toward me with her customary dry smile, but eventually I was reduced to a bitter half-longing for her broken form, hoping to stumble on it somewhere in the rocks and brush. If I could take her body home. Or to Hungary, I sometimes thought, although how I would get into Soviet-controlled Hungary was a conundrum. I would have something of her to honor, to bury, some way to finish this and be alone with my grief. I almost couldn't admit to myself that I wanted her body for another purpose as well. To ascertain whether her death had been completely natural, or if she needed me to fulfill the bitter duty I had carried out for Rossi. Why could I not find her body? Sometimes, especially in the mornings, I felt she had simply fallen, that she would never have left us on purpose. I could believe then that she had an innocent elemental grave somewhere in the woods, even if I would never find it. But by afternoon, I was remembering only her depressions, her strange moods. I knew that I would grieve for the rest of my life, but this utter lack of even her body tormented me. The local doctor gave me a sedative, which I took at night so that I could sleep and build up strength to search the woods again the next day. When the police grew busy with other matters, I searched alone. Sometimes I turned up other relics in the underbrush, stones, crumbling chimneys, once part of a shattered gargoyle. Had it fallen as far as Helen? There were few gargoyles on the monastery walls now. At last my mother and father persuaded me that I could not do this forever, that I should take you back to New York for a while, that I could always come back and look again. Before we left, I asked the abbot to say a blessing for Helen at the far end of the cloister, where she'd jumped. He made a service of it, gathering the monks around him, holding up to the vast air one ritual object after another. It didn't matter to me what they actually were, and chanting to an enormity that swallowed his voice at once. Holding you in my arms, I vowed that I would try to recover some life, a life of some sort.
Barley and I sat looking at each other across my mother's postcards. Like my father's letters, they broke off without giving me much understanding of the present. The main thing, the thing that was burned into my brain, was their dates. She had written them after her death. He's gone to the monastery.
Yes. Let's go.
The road to Saint Mathieu was longer than I'd remembered, dusty and hot even in the late afternoon. There were no cabs in Les Bains, at least none in sight, so we set out on foot. She wouldn't have survived such a fall.
No.
My father never wondered, at least not in his letters, if she was pushed by someone.
That's true.
The walls of the monastery took me by surprise when we came out of the woods around the last bend. I hadn't remembered that bend, or the sudden opening at the peak of the mountain, the huge evening all around us. I barely remembered the flat, dusty area below the front gate, where today there were no cars parked. Where were the tourists, I wondered. A moment later we were close enough to read the sign. Repairs. No visitors this month. It was not enough to slow our footsteps.
Come on.
Barley took my hand and I was deeply glad for it. My own had begun to tremble. The front walls around the gate were ornamented with scaffolding now. A portable cement mixer. Cement? Here? Stood in our path. The wooden doors under the portal were firmly shut but not locked, we discovered, trying the iron ring with cautious hands. We stepped inside, cautiously, and went up into the courtyard and cloisters. The red marble fountain bubbled audibly in the center. We heard a sound, chanting. from the church on the other side of the cloister. Its doors were shut, but we could hear distinctly the progress of a service inside, with intervals of silence.
They're all in there. Maybe your father is too.
But I doubted this. If he's here, he's probably gone down. I paused and looked around the courtyard. It had been almost 2 years since my visit here with my father. My second visit, I now knew, and I couldn't remember for a moment where the opening to the crypt was. Suddenly I saw the doorway, as if it had opened in the nearby wall of the cloisters without my noticing. Barley and I crept across the courtyard to the crypt doorway. Standing there a moment, under the gaze of those frozen beasts, I could see only the shadow into which we would have to descend, and my heart shrank inside me. Then I remembered that my father might be down there, might in fact be in some kind of terrible trouble.
I've got my lighter.
Barley took it out of his pocket. I hadn't known he smoked. He flicked it on for a second, held it above the steps, and we descended together into darkness. At first it was dark indeed, and we were feeling our way down the steepness of the ancient steps. And then I saw a light flickering in the depths of the vault, and I was terribly afraid. That shadowy light was somehow worse than darkness. Barley gripped my hand until I felt the life draining out of it. The stairwell curved at the bottom, and when we came around the last turn, I saw the abbot's great stone sarcophagus. Just then a shadow on the other side of the sarcophagus detached itself from deeper shadows and straightened up. A man holding a lantern. It was my father. His face looked ravaged in the shifting light. He saw us the instant we saw him, I think, and he swore. We stared at each other.
Jesus Christ. What are you doing here?
We read the chapter in the archive at Oxford. I was afraid you... I couldn't finish. Now that we had found him and he was alive and looked like himself, I was shaking all over.
Get out of here. No, it's too late. I don't want you out there alone. We have a few more minutes before the sun sets. Here, hold the light, and you, Barley, help me with the lid.
Barley stepped forward at once, although I thought I saw his knees shaking too, and he helped my father slide the lid slowly off the big sarcophagus. I saw then that my father had propped a long stake against the wall nearby. He must have been prepared for the sight of some long-sought horror in that stone coffin, but not for what he actually saw. I lifted the lantern for him, wanting but not wanting to look, and we all gazed down into the empty space. Dust.
Oh, God. I thought I had the right place, the right date, finally. I thought...
He did not finish, because then there stepped from the shadows of the ancient transept where no light pierced, a figure completely unlike anything any of us had ever seen. It was so strange a presence that I couldn't have screamed even if my throat hadn't immediately closed. My lantern illuminated its feet and legs, one arm and shoulder, but not the shadowed face, and I was too terrified to raise the light higher. I shrank closer to my father, and so did Barley, so that we were all more or less behind the barrier of the empty sarcophagus. The figure drew a little nearer and stopped, its face still shadowed. I could see by then that it had the form of a man, but he did not move like a human being. After the first appalling second, I could see his hands, white as bone against his dark clothing with a jeweled ring on one finger. He was so real, so close to us that I could not breathe. In fact, I began to feel that if I could only force myself to go nearer to him, I would be able to breathe again. And then I began to long to go a little closer. Something glinted where his face must have been. Reddish eyes, teeth, a smile. And then, with a gush of language, he spoke. I call it a gush because I have never heard such a sound, a guttural rush of words that might have been many languages together or one strange language I had never heard. After a moment, it resolved itself.